Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. When we last left Lucy and Desi, they had met. Hey, well, remember how I ended the last episode as he later told Abba what a change in looks the way she looked and now was designed to give me a hard-on. Glad to see you again, Daisy. I'm excited to be working with you. My next picture, I saw you on Broadway. I thought you were terrific. Thanks, said Desi. Now that I've met the real you, I'm going to demand that Abbott write in some hot love scenes with us. That's very flattering, she said. Are you Mexican? No, I'm from Cuba originally. I grew up in Miami. Do you know how to rumba? I think Abbott's going to require it of us in this picture. Lucy said, I don't, but I bet you do. Some of the cast is meeting tonight at this swinging little Mexican joint, El Zarape. It's a restaurant, but they have a small band and dance floor. Will you join us? I'll teach you how to rumba. But she said, I'd love to learn how to rumba. And at the restaurant that night, Desi, Lucille, and a bunch of guys in the cast, they danced, they drank. They ate until 4 o'clock in the morning. You had Hal Leroy there, Libby Bennett, Ivy Scott, and a brand new star, Van Johnson. Lucille had seen them all in the Broadway production. And she later told her good friend Ann Miller, who had played the third lead in Too Many Girls, but who hadn't attended the party. Before dawn, I flipped for this Cubano stud. I might as well confess we retired to the corner of the dive and talked. After 5 minutes, I was in love. Bang, just like that. I adored the way he rolled his R's. I was ready to invite him for a sleepover in my apartment, but I had to meet my family for some urgent business that morning. I had him drop me off at my family home, not at my secret hideaway. Desi told the director, George Abbott, on her doorstep, I fed her some tongue and got her hot, but I couldn't go inside. Her mother was already in the kitchen. She told me cooking breakfast. Later that afternoon, Desi's girlfriend came to town, Renee DeMarco, and they went out to Malibu. And basically, there was a party there with Eddie Bracken, who was the star of Too Many Girls. And they went out there, and Renee's nickname was Freckles, because she freckled so easily. And he introduced her to Van Johnson, who also freckled easily. So they stayed inside, and Desi went outside. He finds Lucille Ball out there, wearing a pink one-piece swimsuit. She's all by herself. And then she looked up at him and said, you've got a body designed for bathing trunks. Personally, I think men's suits are designed to hide too much, especially those baggy pants. She said, why don't you sit down next to me? They talked for 3 hours, leaving his girlfriend inside the house. So he goes inside to check on Freckles. And he found Van Johnson sitting there, and Lucy goes, what happened to Freckles? And Van Johnson said, that damn bitch ran off with that hunk, the pool boy, and I wanted the kid for myself. I'm lonely. Maybe you'd like to come back to my hotel room tonight. Desi said, no, I'm taking Lucille Ball back to her apartment. And he did take her back, invited him inside, invited to spend the night. Now, the only source for what happened next came from the director, George Abbott. The next day, he told all the male cast members of Too Many Girls that Desi had, quote-unquote, plugged Lucille 3 times in one night. I already knew she went for Latin guys. The next thing you know, Desi has moved in with Lucille. But he also rented an apartment of his own where he put his mom. And after his second night with Lucille, Desi called Freckles at her hotel, said, hey, I think things are done. And later that day, Lucille said, hey, can you drive me to Alexander Hall's house? That's the guy that she'd been having the relationship with, the guy who owned the turkey ranch. She had a bunch of suitcase, you know, a bunch of belongings there, her stuff. They'd been together for basically on and off for 5 years. And they get to Alexander Hall's house. He's perfectly happy with the fact that Desi has taken Lucille. You could do no worse. You sneaky Cuban bastard, no hard feelings. Come out back with me. So they went outside. They looked to where he raised the turkeys, and Alexander Hall gets one of the big birds, takes it, chops its heads off, puts it in a bag, gives it to Desi as an engagement present. They get in the car. Lucille says, I'm not taking that damn turkey to my apartment. We'll stop off at the Salvation Army and give it to their cook. And apparently in this conversation, Lucille goes, just how old are you? And Desi goes, I'm 23. Is that too old for you? And Lucille says, hell no, I'm pushing 30. Everybody's going to accuse me of cradle snatching. So they start dating. And everybody in town is in love with Desi. He was the new boy in Tinseltown. He had this black Buick convertible, getting speeding tickets all the time. And he was seeing a lot of women at the time, Ann Miller, Betty Grable, Lana Turner, Jean Tierney, and Lucille. But Ann Miller never told Lucille Ball, who was one of her best friends, that Desi had deflowered me before he got around to plucking her. Now, Too Many Girls was a hit Broadway play, but after it closed on Broadway, RKO purchased the rights and hired Abbott to direct the film's adaptation, which was written by John Twist. And most of the original cast came to same roles that they had on stage. And Johnson, who was a chorus boy, made such an impression upon studio executives that he was offered a contract as a result of his performance. Richard Carlson was new. Ann Miller was new. Frances Langford was new. And it was filmed that summer, premiered on October 8th, 1940, at Lowe's in New York. The reviews were positive. The New York Times said, it's a simple, conventional, rah-rah picture without any place for pretense. He didn't like Desi. Called him a noisy, black-haired Latin whose face unfortunately lacks expression and whose performance is devoid of grace. Variety thought, hey, he's an intriguing film personality that might carry him far. The film did okay financially, but audiences loved Desi Arnaz. And they wrote on comment cards that they liked the Mexican boy, the Spanish actor, the little Argentine fellow, the Cuban boy. They thought he was darn good and excellent. But during the filming of it, many members of the cast warned Lucille against getting serious with Desi. Van Johnson said, just use him like a piece of meat before you move on to the next juicy steak. He's too young and wild for you. A real skirt chaser. If you fall for him, I can almost guarantee you he'll break your heart like he did that of Rene DeMarco. But Lucille said, hey, Van, we know that you just want him for yourself. He told me you've made several passes at him. And they went to... There's a story where Lucy and Desi went to a restaurant. And the waitress came over to Lucille while Desi was in the men's room. He had just ordered a beer. And the waitress said, is your boyfriend an Indian? Because we have a policy of not serving alcohol to Indians. And Lucille said, yes, he's a Cherokee and I'm his squaw. Now bring him the goddamn beer and shut your effing face. Well, you know, Lucille had lived in L.A. for a long time. Desi was new. So she wanted to show him the town. And she said that the problem was when they went out on the town, Desi liked to drive fast. She said the only speed he knew on an open road was 100 miles an hour. Once he hit something jutting out on the highway, which took off his left fender, but he didn't even stop to retrieve it. But she said, you know, I screamed, and one of the reasons I screamed is because Katharine Hepburn, when we made Stage Door, warned me that my voice was too high-pitched. She suggested I go to the beach and scream every day for an hour to lower the register of my voice and make it more suitable for possible dramatic roles. So as Desi drove like a bat out of hell, I screamed. Miss Hepburn was right. I did eventually lower my voice, making better roles suitable for me. They went everywhere. Went to Big Bear, Tijuana, Palm Springs. They would go to Desert Hot Springs, to the nude resorts. They talked about getting married. Said we should have like three kids, two boys for the Desi Arnaz name and a girl who'd grow up to be a beautiful movie star. Now, RKO kind of really liked this new relationship because Desi was super popular. So they had somebody start following them around. The publicity department had the photographers follow them as a couple because they wanted to get their pictures into the newspapers. And they promoted Desi as a new Latin lover like a Valentino. But one night, Desi told Lucille that RKO opposed his getting married until at least 5 years had passed because RKO wanted everybody to know that he was single. That way they can fantasize about me being their lover. Now, during the filming of Too Many Girls, Lucille and Desi often double-dated with Ann Miller and George Abbott, the director. I mean, Ann Miller, we've talked about her. She started off, when she was 13, when Lucille found her, and she changed her ID to be legal. I mean, George Abbott was in his 50s. But Ann Miller dated Louis B. Mayer. And Lucille said Ann believed in reincarnation. She often told us when she reigned over Egypt as Cleopatra, one night she ordered seductions from 80 of her sex slaves before the break of dawn. Ann Miller is just this amazing personality. And one of my favorite interviews with her happened in 1981. And it was when she was doing Sugar Babies with Mickey Rooney on Broadway. And she had been doing it for a couple of years when she gave this interview, but it is just so classic. Somebody like in the early 80s who had been there back in the 30s and the 40s. And so I just want to read it to you a little bit. Ann Miller, the legendary Hollywood hoofer, whose rapid-fire tap dancing blazed across the screen in dozens of iconic film musicals, returned to Broadway for her third and final time in the 1979 burlesque musical comedy revue Sugar Babies. And Mickey Rooney and Ann Miller remained with the production, you know, except for vacations and stuff, for the entirety of the three-year run. Then they even took it on tour. This is Ann Miller in her dressing room at the Mark Hellinger Theater. "Listen, honey," said Ann Miller to a dressing room visitor after a recent performance of Sugar Babies. "I know that some people think I'm 108 years old and bald, but frankly, I don't give a rat's rear anymore. See this hair? Feel it. Tug on it. It's real. It's all mine." The brassy tap star has removed the black lacquered wig she taps in and has had her real hair washed and blown dry by an aide before receiving visitors. Her long, silken black hair is worn pulled back in a bun and is a vast improvement over her trademark wig that has inspired many jokes. "Henny Youngman's the guy who started all those jokes. He doesn't realize that I have to wear a wig when I dance. It's sprayed stiff so I won't get hair in my eyes when I do spins." She wears a red silk David Brown float, huge gold loop earrings, and numerous rings with enormous stones. As big a star as ever, she says to an assistant, "Tell my driver to cool it. I have an interview." The star sits down and launches into a defense of her age. "I was 13 when I made Stage Door at RKO with Katherine Hepburn and Ginger Rogers in 1937. Ginger found out I was underage and tipped off the studio. My father, who was an attorney, had to forge a birth certificate that made me 18. He even changed my birthplace from Houston to Chereno, Texas, to where my mother was born, to throw up the studio. It was the only good thing he ever did for me. But now I'm paying for that lie. Earl Blackwell put in a celebrity register that I was born in 1919. And now everyone thinks I'm 62. What is of more interest than a few years, give or take, is the star's incredibly youthful appearance. Smooth skin, flawless long legs, great shape, and her continuing ability to wow an audience with 525 taps a minute, a flair for slapstick comedy, and a belting voice that has even impressed Ethel Merman. Ethel's seen our show 4 times, and we've gotten to be great friends. In fact, I'm taking a few weeks off from Sugar Babies to do a 2-hour Love Boat special with Ethel, Carol Channing, Della Reese, and Van Johnson. That should be great fun." And she was in a 1982 episode of Love Boat with Ethel, Carol Channing, Della Reese, Van Johnson, and Cab Calloway. Basically, they're all cast as older relatives of the show's regular characters. And Ethel Merman, whew. Just the other day, I rewatched Mad World. She's so good in that. Just beating the hell out of everybody with her purse. The tap queen recently signed a contract for her 3rd year in the burlesque musical at the Mark Hellinger, along with her co-star Mickey Rooney. "I'm not at all bored with the show. The audience is different every performance. Sometimes they're great, sometimes they're awful. Tonight, they were rotten. They were glum, sat on their hands and smiled. We need laughs. They must have been New Yorkers. This is not a show for blasé New Yorkers. It's for tourists and out-of-towners. They love us. Mickey gets hopping mad if the audience doesn't laugh at his first couple jokes." Also, Mickey was in Mad World. "And he stays mad for the rest of the performance. I'm not trying to put him down, but he hasn't learned yet that you have to woo a bad audience like a lover. That's what I do. We have no problem in matinees. The ladies all love Mickey. As soon as he walks out, he's got them in the lap of his hands." Anne is as famous for her Millerisms as the late Sam Goldwyn was for his Goldwynisms. Some sample Millerisms. Asked what she was doing for Passover, she reportedly replied, "I don't do game shows." On a questionnaire which requested her occupation, she printed "star." Recently, they say, she was amazed to discover that Christmas always falls on Christ's birthday. Some of those stories are made up, but some are true. "I say things in innocence and they come out funny. Like the time I read that someone was producing a Broadway musical called Ari. I thought it was about Aristotle and asses, so I called my friend, that big agent Milton Goldman, and told him that I wanted to play Jackie in that show. After all, I had dark hair like hers." Well, Milton fell on the floor, I think. He couldn't stop laughing. The story spread all over town and it made the papers. Ari was not about Onassis. It was a musical version of the novel Exodus. Ann Miller, who was christened Johnny Lucille Collier because her father wanted a boy, began tapping as a small child to help support her mother. My parents split when I was small and we were practically starving. I started dancing at the Elks and Rotary Clubs and at the Orpheum Theater in Los Angeles. I worked with a pianist named Harry Fields and he studied numerology. He figured out a better name for me, Ann Miller, and I've kept it ever since. Little Ann Miller was discovered by Lucille Ball and Benny Rubin tapping away in a San Francisco nightclub. That's how I got my RKO contract, and that's when a man named Cheryl Corwin, who had helped me with my act, told me to lie about my age. "You're tall," he said, "and if you put on a lot of makeup, nobody will know the difference." He was right. It worked. And Ann began her film career tapping in such revivals as New Faces of 1937 and all this kind of stuff. You Can't Take It With You, starring James Stewart. I got fat making that one because Jimmy Stewart kept feeding me candy bars. When I went to New York to make my Broadway debut in the 1939 George White scandals, Mr. White took one look at me and put me on a diet. I lost weight and I was a smash in the show with two great numbers to do. I made the cover of the News and the Mirror and got to meet fabulous people. And now I'm starring in Sugar Babies at the theater named in Mark Hellinger's honor. Miller's golden period occurred at MGM in the late 1940s and 50s when her machine gun tapping triumphed in such memorable musicals as Kiss Me Kate, her favorite, Easter Parade, On the Town, and some others. Her return to Broadway in 1969 as the last of the stars to play the title role in Mame was sensational. On her opening night, when she pulled her tap shoes out of her bag, she got an ovation before she even started tapping. Summing up her career that has spanned 44 years, Ann remarks, "I've been blessed like a cat with nine tails." And then she talked about an accident she had during rehearsals for Sugar Babies. She said it happened at Tony Bennett's rehearsal studio, but she meant Michael Bennett. The Woman Defamation League voted me Woman of the Year. She's trying to recall another word. She said, it's named after the dancer. What's his name? Cohen or something? She means George M. Cohen. One of her fond memories is that of living at the Gorham Hotel in Manhattan with her mother when she was appearing in the scandals. Mary Martin had the suite right above us, and her little boy used to drive us crazy. He was always running all over the place, and we could hear the pitter-patter of his feet night and day. Well, just the other night, that boy, Larry Hagman, also known as J.R. Ewing of Dallas fame, came to my dressing room wearing his big cowboy hat and carrying his cane. He said, "Ann, you're not going to believe this, but I'm the little kid who used to live right over you at the Gorham Hotel." Other visitors to Ann's dressing room have included President and Mrs. Reagan. I've known them for 35 years, and they're going to see the show again. Helen Hayes, Cary Grant, Katherine Hepburn. One night I heard this familiar husky voice calling outside my dressing room, "Where's Stringbean? I want to see Stringbean." It was Katherine Hepburn calling me by the name I had in stage door when I appeared in it with her. She's such a great lady. I was honored to have her in my dressing room. I'll never forget making stage door. Every afternoon at 4, Katherine had a tea break, and I got to eat all kinds of cakes and cookies. She goes, "Yeah, there's something for everyone in this show. Of course, a lot of people think it's a family show, and they bring their kids. It's not really a family show. The jokes get very raunchy. But at least the singing, dancing, and the juggler don't let them down. That juggler's terrific. I'm so glad he joined our show." And she never hedges a question. Not even one about her reported feud with Ann Gillian, a former performer in her show. She was my very good friend when she was in Sugar Babies. In fact, I saved her job three times because they were going to fire her. To think that I used to let her ride in my car with me and take her and her husband, who's a cop, to dinner. Well, it seems that Ann's been giving out interviews to newspapers and to TV Guide claiming that she left the show because I took her part away from her. That's ugly, and there's not a word of truth in it. When I had my accident during rehearsals of her show, they had to have someone doing my numbers. They had to time them. So they gave Ann some of my numbers and gave other girls some of the other specialties I do. But as soon as I recovered, they gave all my numbers back to me. And that's when Ann went around saying I had taken her part away from her. She was never the star of the show. I'm the star. And dumping on me is not very nice. Ann Miller had been married three times, but not happily. She's told interviewers that she'll never marry again. She has, through the years, socialized with such luminaries as Conrad Hilton, Cole Porter, and George Abbott. They all wanted to dance with me. And she recently lost her mother. It was a terrible blow to me. She died in California in August, and the producers and Mickey were wonderful to me. They let me fly to the coast to be there at the end. My mother was an incredible person. She wore 10 hats. She was my driver. She cleaned the house, cooked, did my secretarial work, managed my career, and even got me publicity. Once, when I was in New York, I asked her to send me my Christmas card mailing list. She sent me two California phone books. You know, this may sound strange, but there's an old superstition that you must never wear real peacock feathers. If you do, there's a death in your family. Well, they gave me a new costume last August for Sugar Babies, and it had a stole of real peacock feathers. I only wore it once, and the next night, my mother died. How does the star feel about Miss Piggy doing an Ann Miller takeoff in the current film, The Great Muppet Caper? I can't wait to see it. I love Miss Piggy. She's every tacky thing that a female star ever did. I think her eyes are like mine. And then she pointed to a huge Miss Piggy poster hanging on a door. Do you know what I'd really love next to another hit show written especially for me? I'd love to have a tap-off with her. Then the papers could headline Miss Piggy meets Miss Wiggy. Oh. But both Abbott and Desi taught Ann Miller and Lucille how to rumba, and they were often seen at Zarape, which at Desi's request had imported a band from Havana. Now, in his opening scene for Too Many Girls, as his character met his romantic counterpart Lucille for the first time, Desi was required to, you know, facially register the visuals of her gorgeous body and then swoon. I got paid for doing what came naturally. And according to Miller, whenever the two of them weren't on camera, but scheduled to go on together soon, you could see them sitting off somewhere in a corner practically making out. They couldn't seem to get enough of each other. In the bluntest of terms, they had the hots for each other, seemingly not able to wait until they returned to her dressing room, which they did frequently. Was I jealous? Okay, I admit a little bit. And eventually, Lucille and Desi met their co-stars, Richard Carlson and Francis Langford. Carlson was cast in the lead as Clint Kelly. Richard Colmar, who had portrayed that character on Broadway, stayed back in New York because he married Dorothy Kilgallen. We've talked about that before. And Carlson, well, you know, was on the dawn of a big career in films and television. But Frances Langford, she was born in Lakeland, Florida. And from the moment she first stepped in front of a band, she became known as the Florida Thrush. And she really wanted to go into opera, but she had a throat operation when she was still a teenager and it changed her voice. But she made her first professional appearance when she was 16 on a tiny local radio station. And it was heard by Rudy Valley. And basically, he promptly offered her a spot on his network radio show at the age of 16. And it was the first link in this chain that led to stardom. In the George Raft, Alice Faye film, Langford was seen singing I'm in the Mood for Love. And movie producers loved it, and they wanted more of her. She wasn't conventionally pretty because they said her eyes could look a little too far apart and her mouth was too big. But her voice was made for, you know, that kind of singing musical style that was really popular in movies. And her appearances with Bob Hope started in 1941, the year of Pearl Harbor. That's when he started his troop concerts, and then she would be on his radio show. And she toured the war zones in Africa and Italy. She went with Bob Hope to the Pacific. She also was probably sleeping with him. But she caused a storm by hitching a ride in a P-38 Lightning fighter, totally against military rules. And then the plane went into action and strafed like a beached Japanese ship. And when she met Langford, Lucille asked her, how does it feel to be married to John Hall, a living doll that half the world desires? And Langford replies, I have to line up, and there's always a long line waiting just to get him to F me. Now, John Hall is famous in Hollywood history for something called the Battle of the Balcony. And it happened back on August 5th, 1944. It was huge. Probably the biggest celebrity brawl of all time between two people. It happened at Tommy Dorsey's apartment at 1220 Sunset Plaza Drive. And you had Tommy Dorsey, you had John Hall. At that point, he had recently played the lead in a Kit Carson movie. And Dorsey had been drinking for the better part of 8 hours. And he and his wife, the actress Patricia Dane, had spent the evening nightclubbing on the Strip celebrating her 26th birthday. And they were ending the night at their place with like a nightcap party. And Dorsey was a violent drunk. And apparently he had taken offense when he had seen Hall give Mrs. Dorsey what was just a normal Hollywood hug at the front door. Dorsey calls Hall onto the balcony, second floor apartment, smashes him in the nose with a bottle. And in the fight that ensued, Dorsey got the upper hand, wrestles Hall up onto the balcony railing, threatening to push him over the side. So then Hall puts his hands around Dorsey's neck, says, if I go, I'm taking you with me. The other partygoers who were getting into the cars in the driveway below hear the commotion. They rush back upstairs. In the meantime, however, Mrs. Dorsey rushed next door and returned with the Dorsey's neighbor, Alan Smiley. He's a gangster who just happened to be mob boss Bugsy Siegel's right-hand man. We don't know exactly what happened because it was before the others rushed back upstairs. What is known as this? Someone slashed John Hall multiple times about the face and neck. They sliced one of his nostrils clean through with an instrument of some sort that Hall's doctor would later say was as sharp as a surgeon's knife. So the rescuers come from downstairs. John Hall stumbles out of the apartment, gets into his car, drives himself to a hospital, and he required over 50 stitches to his face, his neck, his upper body. And to protect the surgical stitching of his sliced nostril, he was seen about town wearing like a nose guard. It inspired Jack Nicholson's character in Chinatown. A dozen witnesses to the Battle of the Balcony. Sun rises the next day, and they all develop this strange case of collective amnesia. Especially about who wielded the weapon, or what the weapon could have been. The Dorsey speculated that Hall might have been cut with shards from broken flower pots. There was a suggestion that it may have been the petite Mrs. Dorsey herself who inflicted the wounds. One witness, Jane Churchill, told a reporter that she had been approached by associates of Alan Smiley and Bugsy Siegel, who she said recommended that she keep silent about the fight. Several weeks after her statement was reported in the Times, Churchill's knee was broken. She claimed that it happened during an automobile accident. Despite the fact that John Hall refused to press charges, the DA charged Tommy and Pat Dorsey and Alan Smiley with assault. And this was a big inconvenience to Smiley because he and Bugsy happened to be out on bail after being busted for bookmaking at the Sunset Tower Apartments in May. A conviction would be problematic. It was that factor, of course, that explains why no one involved in the Battle of the Balcony could remember who wielded the weapon. And that bookmaking thing had just happened, like I said, in the previous May. And Bugsy and Smiley were arrested basically just for bookmaking because the detectives had found Bugsy in his apartment with Alan playing cards with Bugsy's brother-in-law, Sally Soloway, and actor George Raft, the A-list tough guy who was going to make another appearance later. But detectives had been listening in on phone calls as Bugsy placed bets at Tracks back east, and a search of the apartment turned up betting slips bearing the names of Hollywood stars, as well as a list of names said to be local bookies. Bugsy and Smiley were arrested, but Raft and Soloway were not charged. And later on, I think that Raft testified for both of them, and they were only fined like $250. But on the set of Too Many Girls, word spread among the crew that Desi was actually hooking up with Langford. And she's always denied it, but maybe. And Garson Kanin, who had directed Lucille in Next Time I Marry, was an assistant to George Abbott during the filming of Too Many Girls. And he became the first guy in Hollywood to realize, hey, you know, Desi might have more potential than beating bongo drums and singing Babaloo. And Kanin said, unlike most actors, Desi set out to learn everything he could about how films were made. Of course, he was a pain in the ass on the set, always interfering, wanting to set up every scene himself and even direct it. He was also giving Abbott and me suggestions about what to do in every scene. And he also said that Lucille had been cast in the film under a cloud of rejection because the guy in charge of RKO's B-movies didn't think that she was right. Said that she was too old to play a co-ed. They suggested that, hey, look for somebody younger who hadn't previously played a hooker. But they did sign Lucille. Everybody thought that Desi was perfectly cast. And after they would get off work, Desi and Lucy would go, you know, to all the hot spots that she wanted to show him. On Saturday nights, they would go to like 3 different showrooms a night. And the popular gossip columnist, Sheila Graham, who we're going to talk about in the history of gossip, she lived in the same apartment building as Lucille. And at the time, she was engaged in an affair with F. Scott Fitzgerald. The guy wrote Great Gatsby. And like I said, I don't want to say too much about Sheila because we're going to do an episode about that kind of time period. But it's really interesting is that she wrote this column, Hollywood Today. She wrote it daily for over 35 years. She did serve as a war correspondent during World War II. But the column at its peak was carried in 178 papers, compared to 100 papers for Luella Parsons and 68 for Hedda Hopper. But Graham described the three of them as the last of the unholy trio. But she would say, out on her balcony, Scott and I could hear Lucille's frequent arguments with Desi. Most of the arguments centered on his roving eye. Even though he seemed madly in love with her, he just couldn't seem to keep it zipped up. He would accuse her of having an affair with her handsome co-star, Richard Carlson, and she would claim that he was banging Francis Langford. See? So there might be something to that. They would really go at it, setting an early pattern for their upcoming marriage. And apparently the makeup sessions following a bitter fight were very vocal. Scott and I could hear the sounds of their lovemaking through the open doors of their balcony drifting down to our landing. Lucille seemed like a director in bed, giving him guidance on what spots to hit. They went to lunch one day and they ran into Mae West and Marlene Dietrich, which is interesting. But then their main kind of hangout was at Trocadero. Desi called it the Troc. And basically, it was just where all the moguls hung out, like Samuel Goldwyn, Louis B. Mayer. And it was believed that it was here that Mayer saw Lucille dancing with Desi. And that's what got him to lure her away from RKO and to sign her at MGM. One night, Fred Astaire showed up with his wife, Phyllis, and invited Lucille to dance. And rumor is that when they were dancing, "You, not Ginger Rogers, should have been my dance partner." Lucille said, "My God." But when she wasn't with him, Desi developed a fondness for prostitutes. Okay. He was sometimes seen coming and going from Club Mount Air. Seven buildings away, Brenda Allen ran a bordello where she costumed and made up her ladies as movie stars. And Desi said if an hombre couldn't get Lana Turner or Betty Grable on the hoof, he could get a look-alike from Miss Allen. "Just to see what it was like, I sampled Shirley Temple one night. The kid went for my lollipop." A term she used based on Shirley's song On the Good Ship, Lollipop. Now, Brenda Allen, she was royally screwed over. In 1948, there was a headline in the LA Times. "Names found in vice raid set Hollywood agog." And everybody's like, uh-oh. Because the report that followed contained career-killing news. During a raid on the bordello Hollywood Madam Brenda Allen operated above the Sunset Strip, police had confiscated a box of index cards containing the names, contact info, and sexual predilections of about 250 men, whom the Times article described as notables of the film colony. And it got worse. A photo captioned "lots of names" showed a uniformed LAPD officer pawing through the files, which appeared to be casually spread across the desk. Okay. And this was not the first time or the last time. But basically, you get like this suppressed panic among the names on the madam's list, followed by secret shenanigans among lawyers and agents and studio executives, behind-the-scenes negotiations among lawyers and police, a little cash, to make sure the names would never see the light of the day. Now, we'll never know whether something like that happened, but we do know what the outcome was. During Brenda's trial on the charge of running a house of ill fame, the judge reviewed all the cards. And he said, "In the box are names of dignitaries of the screen and radio and executives with responsible positions in many great industries. Publication of their names would be ruinous to their careers and cause them great public disgrace. I order the exhibit sealed." Then he found Brenda Allen guilty. But Brenda had been paying corrupt officers, right, for protection. And the detective of the vice squad was her lover and her business partner. And all of these people were involved. And it exploded into public view like a year to the day after she was busted. Because Mickey Cohen, the mobster, announced during a trial on an unrelated matter that he had in his possession recordings of telephone conversations between Brenda Allen and this vice detective. Calls made to and by the detective in his office at LAPD headquarters. It made the police chief resign, five other top LAPD officials. And they were charged with lying to a grand jury. Everybody's charged with taking bribes. But the only person that was ever convicted was Brenda Allen. One time, Lucy and Desi went to Nate and Al's. Great place. Oh, God. I want it now. One night they found Groucho there, but this was also the time where they met Frank Sinatra, for the first time. And waiting for him in the car outside were a redhead and a blonde, and he told Desi, "I'm trying to break into the movies. Otherwise, I might have become a mobster in Jersey." Now, when Desi wasn't escorting Lucille around, he was seen betting on the horses at Santa Anita. He loved doing that. And also, he was playing a lot of cards, and he began to receive invitations to private poker games. And sometimes, you know, they were at the homes of producers, like Samuel Goldwyn. Sometimes he would come with his new best friend, Humphrey Bogart. Jack Warner might show up. And during the filming of Too Many Girls, Lucille celebrated her 29th birthday, and Desi threw five separate surprise parties for her. But there was always a person lurking in the background. And when Lucille was needed at the studio, and Desi had the day off, he sometimes went out with Lana Turner. And they were spotted together at the Santa Anita racetrack, and also at certain different restaurants and bars. There's one version that said that Lana and Desi had a relationship back when Desi was in New York, and that Lana thought that they had a real thing going, but when he left to shoot Too Many Girls, that Desi met Lucille and ended his romance with Lana. That's kind of the popular version. Now, Lucille heard about Desi and Lana Turner. They had a huge fight, and he promised never to see Lana Turner again. But a week later, someone spotted them together entering a place on the Strip. So Lucille decided to take drastic measures. And she calls George Raft, the ex-gangster, her former boyfriend. And Raft came to her aid. And he was a close friend of Bugsy Siegel, like I said earlier. And Raft also seduced Jean Harlow and Mae West, later years Marilyn Monroe. Raft had a reputation as God's gift to women. And he always carried a locket containing five pubic hairs from Harlow. He had bought them for $500 each, and they'd been plucked by an orderly while she was laid out unconscious on a hospital bed. But Raft came up with a plan to scare Desi from dating Lana. So one night, Desi parks his car and was headed to his own apartment to be with his mom. And two of Siegel's henchmen approached him. They point a gun at his head. He was forced into the backseat of the car and driven out into the remote California countryside. He was stripped of his clothes, left totally naked, no money to get back into town. Now, no one knows for sure what happened that night, but Lana Turner later heard that no motorist wanted to stop in the desert. It's the middle of the night to pick up a naked guy. But then two gay men stopped for him, invited him into their car, and they had a home a couple miles away. And Desi was asked in for drinks and to spend the night. Now, Desi never discussed what happened later that night, but he showed up at his own apartment late the following morning, having been clothed and driven there by one of those two guys, who, as it happened, worked in the makeup department at Warner's. So even though Lucille, with Raft's help, seemed to have ended Desi's affair with Lana Turner, she knew there's going to be others. She knew, if I get married to him, that's going to happen every single day. And she discussed it with Ann Miller. And look, said this, there are more handsome young men in Hollywood than anywhere else in the world. And some are actually straight. Maybe you'll go out on a few dates when Desi's away doing what he does. Live it up, girl. Don't sit at home waiting for any man. After all, you and I aren't getting any younger. Now, in the next episode, we're going to talk about Lucy and Desi, a separation while Lucy films and Desi goes and does Chicago for Too Many Girls, but they're also going to get married. That's it for this one, you guys. I will talk to you later.